91 to 2005.
Whose office?
Excuse my interruption, everyone. But with that gavel, I will call to order this meeting of the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. Today is March 5th, 2015, and I am co-chair Gomberg. Co-chair Johnson will be delayed today, as will Representative Whitsitt, but we'll go ahead and get underway so that we can have plenty of time, unlike those unruly folks in land use, water, and rural communities who kept our room until about 3 minutes after 3, delaying our proceedings here. So with that, Mr. Burka, we are going to be reviewing 5535, the Public Utility Commission, today and tomorrow.
Chair Gomberg and members of the committee, you'll just be reviewing them today.
Oh, I'm sorry.
If we don't get to public testimony for any reason, we can hold it over until next time.
That's right, because tomorrow is Friday. I misspoke. So let me exercise the gavel once again and open the hearing on Senate Bill 5535, again, the Oregon Public Utility Commission. And I believe we have a panel that's already here. I'll let you introduce yourselves.
Thank you, Co-Chair Gomberg. Is my distance about right?
You
here?
Are perfect.
Okay. We've got those sensitive mics at the PUC, too, and we've discovered that people can't actually use the letter P in any of their discussions because it's so percussive.
And that's very difficult with your agency.
Yes, it is, sir. Anyway, sir, my name is Susan Akron. I'm chair of the Public Utility Commission, and I'm going to let Mike Doherty introduce himself and then...
Chair Gumberg, members of the committee, my name is Michael Doherty, and I'm the Chief Operating Officer of the Public Utility Commission.
For the record, my name is Travis Miller. I'm with the Chief Financial Office.
Then we'll just go right into it. And we've got about 40 slides, I think, which we'll try to run through relatively quickly. But please interrupt me if you have questions. I'd be happy to answer any. So to begin with, on this cover slide, we're going to move on. So you see, these are the three commissioners. The commission is three people who are appointed by the governor. We are confirmed by the Oregon Senate, and we serve four-year staggered terms, and we are full-time. Our mission statement, going to the next one, is to ensure that there are safe and reliable utility services provided to consumers at just and reasonable rates through both regulation and promoting development of competition in the right areas. We receive no general or lottery funds. The commission's responsibilities are funded through a per-month charge on the bills of regulated gas, electric, telecommunications, and water utilities. Right now, that per-month charge is equal to about 17 cents per bill. Going into our statutory authority, we're really regulated by state laws, federal laws, and judicial decisions. Both Congress and the state of Oregon has passed laws to encourage competition in electricity and telecommunications markets, and so when we're not regulating, we're trying to encourage that. We base our authority on several chapters of state law. General powers are set out in Oregon Revised Statutes Chapter 756. That chapter authorizes us to represent the customers of any electric and natural gas utilities, telecommunications utilities, water utility, and public generally in all controversies respecting rates, violations, evaluations, service, and all matters of which we have jurisdiction. It authorizes us to set rates and determine the terms and conditions of service by utilities. It gives us authority to investigate the management and records of regulated utilities, to investigate complaints against utilities, and take any other actions necessary to protect customers. This is a key aspect of our regulation, actually, with the final one, which is to balance the interests of the utility investor and the consumer in establishing fair and reasonable rates. So going more detail into our statutory authority, ORS Chapter 757 and 758 set out the laws for energy and water regulation. 757 relates to utility regulation generally, and 758 deals with things like utility rights of way, service agreements, service allocations, and cogeneration policies. Chapter 759 sets out the laws that are relative to telecommunications regulation. Our own administrative rules are found in Chapter 860, the Oregon Administrative Rules. That defines the standards by which we carry out our responsibilities, and they deal with everything from rate filing procedures to safety standards and customer complaint procedures. Finally, the legislature frequently gives us things to administer, and they're found in these chapters, and we do that. One is Chapter 290, which is the Residential Service Protection Fund. You'll see that come up later in the hearing, but it's RSPF is what we call it, but it's the Residential Service Protection Fund. Energy conservation is in Chapter 469. The Renewable Portfolio Standard is in Chapter 469A. Rights of Way are described in Chapter 772, and the Bureau of Maritime Pilots is discussed in Chapter 776. A little bit of historical perspective about us. We are one of the oldest agencies in the state of Oregon, maybe one of the oldest organized groups in the state of Oregon. The first statute was in 1843 to regulate a utility, and that was about 16 years before we became a state. And my understanding is that regulation related to granaries, mill, and millers, which, of course, we don't regulate anymore, so things have changed. But in 1887, the Oregon legislature established a Board of Railroad Commissioners. That board was later reorganized with the powers to regulate utilities and transportation. We were renamed the Public Service Commission in 1915, and in 1931, the PSC was abolished and the Office of Public Utility Commissioner was established. That stayed there until 1986, when Oregon voters approved a ballot measure which changed us back to a three-person governor-appointed commission and changed the name to the Oregon Public Utility Commission. That is basically the current setup and the way we operate and do business. This is just one fun fact about us that Mike threw on, and I think it's worth it. State employee position numbers 1 and 3 reside at the PUC, so we've been around a long time, and we have some long-term employees as well. Going on to the scope of our regulation, which is next, we regulate investor-owned, in other words, privately held utilities, three private electric utilities, PGE, PacifiCorp, and Idaho Power. We regulate three investor-owned natural gas utilities. That's Northwest Natural, Avista, and Cascade. And there are about 390 telecommunication companies of various iterations that we regulate on various levels. About 80 small water companies. And anyway, you can see how broad-based the regulation is. There are over 3 million customers are protected under our jurisdiction. Again, the scope of regulation, the total revenue collected by the utilities we regulate is just under $5 billion per year. Investor-owned electric utilities count for about two-thirds of the electricity that is actually sold in the state and about three-quarters of the electric customers in Oregon. The remainder are served by public power utilities, which we don't regulate, at least for cost of service purposes. The investor-owned utility gas utilities account for all the sales and distribution of natural gas in this state. There's no equivalent to public power on the natural gas side, although there are in some other states, but Oregon doesn't have any. IOUs have the ability to ask for rate increases at their discretion. The frequency of rate increase requests has been almost annually in recent years. And our responsibilities when the utilities come in for these requests are to represent the customers of the public utility or the telecommunications utility and the public generally in all controversies respecting their rates, valuation service, and any matters of which the commission has jurisdiction. I call this the public interest. That's what we're regulating for, is the public interest. And so in that regulation, we balance the interests between the ratepayers and utilities, because sometimes those interests conflict. And another thing we do is we manage the effects of various pieces of legislation, state and federal, on utility costs, system performance, and system reliability. And some examples are the Direct Access Bill that passed in 1999, Renewable Portfolio Standard, greenhouse gas emissions issues, net metering, solar photovoltaics, I always have a hard time getting that one out, and various other pieces of policy that the legislature adapts for us. So the next few slides are just some of the things we do. We set utility rates for homes and businesses, and we ensure that rates are just and reasonable. The phrase just and reasonable is in the statute, and it has about close to 100 years now of judicial interpretation, what that means. So it's a very finely tuned term of art in our business. So we set and enforce price and service rules to protect consumers. We ensure that private energy utilities are meeting customer resource needs at the combination of lowest cost and risk. That's a process we call integrated resource planning, and what that means is you can acquire extremely low resource cost resources that aren't good for consumers over the long term because the risks of costs going way up make them not valuable for consumers to take. So that's what that combination of lowest cost and risk means. We approve a wide variety of utility transactions, such as mergers, property sales, and acquisitions, that sort of thing. We set and enforce service quality standards. We resolve customer complaints about their utilities. We manage a program, it's about $33 million per year, that provides affordable phones in high-cost areas of the state. We set and enforce rules for fair competition in energy and telecommunications where the law has given us that responsibility. And we have a safety function, and that ensures pipelines, power lines, transformers, and other energy facilities are operated safely. And this is the one exception to the rule that we don't regulate public power. We also have regulatory authority for safety over the public power utilities in our state. We advocate on behalf of Oregon in a regional and federal forums such as the Bonneville Power Administration, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and the Federal Communications Commission. We administer the Residential Service Protection Fund, more on that later, and we regulate to ensure that the Oregon Energy Trust acquires cost-effective energy efficiency on behalf of PacifiCorp, PGE, Northwest Natural Gas, and Cascade Natural Gas, and we ask them to do that primarily through competitive processes so that their acquisition of resources is efficient too. And finally, we have oversight of regulated energy providers regarding seismic issues and cybersecurity preparedness. The next slide is our organizational chart, and as you can see, we have three large branches underneath us, and we'll go into those in more detail later. The first big branch is the utility program. This is 75 and a quarter full-time equivalent employees. These employees are energy experts. They do energy resources and planning. They are responsible for rates, finance, and audit. There's also a telecommunications and water section within that group. And they deal with service quality, rates, and water, and competitive issues in universal service for telecommunications. Within that program is also our safety group. This is a group of engineers that undertakes utility safety, reliability, and security regulation, and then consumer services, and that's the group of people that help consumers with resolve complaints that they have with their utilities. So the utility program, which is that first big group cluster of employees we have, is really the core of what we do because this is the technical and analytical arm of the Public Utility Commission. The employees there tend to be accountants, economists, finance people, engineers, lawyers, and other people with a high level of expertise in their areas. The utility program provides us with financial, accounting, engineering, and economics-oriented analysis. They review utility plant operations, capital improvements, utility and telecommunications services, cost of capital issues, property and other transactions, electric and telecommunications competition, renewable adjustment clauses, which is a clause that allows the utilities to recover the cost of the renewable resources under the renewable portfolio standard, purchase gas costs for the natural gas utilities, and power costs for the electric utilities. Finally, a big chunk of what we do is to oversee the Energy Trust of Oregon to assure that it's producing good results, both in terms of the conservation savings it's acquiring and renewable resource development, and that it does so efficiently. Our oversight includes yearly performance measures. We have a grant agreement with them that describes their obligations to us and to consumers. They file quarterly and annual reports to us, which are reviewed by the commission and by staff. There are regular management coordination meetings between the ETO and the PUC. We yearly review their budgets and their action plans, and we have independent management audits of the ETO every 5 years, and of course every year there's an independent financial analysis of their books. This next slide is just to, it kind of shows you a little bit of how we have brought benefit to consumers of Oregon. In these past few years, these are the differences between what utilities ask for in the way of cost increases and what we actually approved. So those red bars represents savings in millions to consumers in the state in those years. We mentioned this earlier, but this is another big chunk of our both our revenue and our budget every year, which is the Residential Service Protection Fund. The RSPF supports the state's public policy that all Oregonians should have access to adequate and affordable telephone service. It consists of four programs. We have eight full-time employees that administer that program. One is the Oregon Telephone Assistance Program. The second is the Oregon Telecommunications Relay Service. The third is the Telecommunications Device Assistance Program. And the fourth is the Emergency Medical Certificate Program. These programs are funded by a charge on telecommunications bills. The charge decreased more recently over the past 2 years from 12 cents to 9 cents. The statutory maximum is 35 cents per month. So what these programs do, OTAP Lifeline, there are approximately 90,000 Oregonians that are served under that. And these are funds that are released to low-qualifying, low-income consumers and helps them afford telephones. They get about $9.25 a month from the federal government and $3.50 from the Oregon Universal Service Program, and that's one. It includes free telephones. We've had a great increase in the last few years for requests for free telephones under this program. And for requests for bill payment assistance. TDAP is actually what I would call special equipment for people that need special equipment in order to utilize the phone system. So these are special phones and things for hearing or speech impaired and helps them communicate. There are about 7,100 Oregonians that get service under that program. The Oregon Telecommunications Relay Service operates 24 hours a day. And provides approximately 439 calls annually. We don't actually operate that one. That one is operated under contract to Sprint. Emergency medical certificates, when consumers have certain medical conditions where they cannot be disconnected from their phone, they can ask for an emergency medical certificate, and we work with the utilities and those consumers to make sure that their service is maintained. We recently, you might have heard about this, introduced what we called lockdown tablets, which are iPad minis and iPads, as an assistive telecommunications device under the TDAP program to qualifying customers. We've got about 26 people that are piloting this program for us. Some of this equipment can be really expensive. Mike has told me we have pieces of equipment that cost $7,000 to help these people. But these iPads serve the function and at a substantially reduced cost, $400 and $500 compared to $7,000. So if you are hearing impaired or speech impaired, you can use the FaceTime function, for example, on a Facebook, or not Facebook, excuse me, on an iPad to do American Sign Language person to person. And so that's something we're piloting right now. We're hoping that we can make that work. As of March 2014, the RSPF collected about almost $125,000 in penalties, interest, and late reporting fees from the telecommunications providers for delinquent surcharge remittances. And we just tell you that because we take the program seriously and there are a lot of consumers that depend on it. So I'm going to move on to the next big division within the commission, which is the Administrative Hearings Division. The Administrative Hearings Division is an independent division within the commission. It reports directly to the commission, and it has about 10 and a half full-time equivalent employees. These are basically lawyers that judge cases that come in front of us, so they act like judges. And we have our own administrative law judges. We were exempt from the use of the Office of Administrative Hearings a few years back because these ALJs require some special expertise and the cases are so complicated. So they're within the, they're the second major chunk of our agency. The cases can be very highly complex, from rate cases to investigations, and then they can be as simple as just straightforward consumer complaints. The third big chunk of our organization is the policy administration chunk. This is 31 3/4 full-time equivalent employees. It's the three commissioners and the commission office. The commission office are the good people that support us. I think they're watching today, so I wanted to make sure they knew that. Our chief operating officer, who's here to my left and your right, our human resources department, which includes training and reception, business services, and information technology, is all in the policy administrative function. The Residential Service Protection Fund, which I spent a bit of time just talking about, is also within policy administration, and the Board of Maritime Pilots at 1.5 full-time equivalent employees is under policy administration. We don't actually regulate the Board of Maritime Pilots. They're under us for administrative purposes, though. They're so small, they need help with administrative work, and that's what we do for them. So the Board of Maritime Pilots helps protect public health, safety, and welfare by ensuring that only the best qualified persons are licensed to pilot vessels. These pilots are essential to our maritime commerce. They direct transit of vessels calling on the ports of Coos Bay, Yacuna Bay, Astoria, Kalama, Longview, Vancouver, Pasco, and Portland. And as I said, it's 1.5 full-time equivalent employees. So on slide 24, we meet our responsibilities to the state of Oregon through 21 key performance measures. 8 of them relate to energy, 3 relate to safety, reliability, and security. 1 relates to telecommunications, 1 to water, 2 relate to the Residential Service Protection Fund, 2 relates to consumer services, and 1 to the Administrative Hearings Division. There's one big one that includes 5 parts related to Energy Trust of Oregon. That is something that was adopted by this committee in 2013. And then 2 relate to the Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots. So the next few pages describe what our performance measures are all about. Our goal is to maintain electricity rates that are lower than the national average, to acquire low-cost energy conservation efficiently and effectively, to prevent personal injury to electricity, natural gas customers, and industry workers as well, to maintain a healthy level of competition in the telecommunications and electric industries, to promote pricing that encourages the efficient use of water and energy, to investigate consumer complaints and issue complaint orders in a timely fashion, maintain a high level of agency customer service, and successfully inform target populations about the availability of the special telecommunications programs that are out there. Finally, maintaining effective ETO performance. So we have 5 of our key performance measures, numbers 5 through 9. We are going to request for deletion as the new key performance measure 21, letters A through E, more accurately track ETO performance, and those were the ones that were adopted last year. So 5 through 9 can go away. 4 of our performance measures did not make targets, and they're there if you're interested. Going on to, I think, more of what you're interested in, which is our budget overview. These 2 pie charts are, on the left is represents our limited funds budget. There's a little slice in there of federal funds that helps pay for our natural gas safety program. But other than that, the other funds, well, we'll talk about those later. Non-limited funds is on the right-hand side in the purple graph, and that's the Oregon Universal Service Fund. That is the fund that collects a per-month charge from telecommunications bills, and it's used to buy down the cost of high-cost telecommunications services in high-cost parts of the state. And that is simply a pass-through. That's $66 million per biennium. The next slide is our budget overview. Again, is on the left-hand side, this is kind of a program breakdown so you can see where our money goes. On the left, limited funds, again, the big bulk is in the utility program. There's another chunk for policy administration. Finally, there's the Residential Service Protection Fund, and the Board of Maritime Pilots is in there at about a little over $700,000. And then again, non-limited funds, which is a pass through the OUSF collections on the right-hand side. The next are more graphical depictions of our agency. This first one is our limited funds expenditure over the years. So you can see we're a pretty steady state agency. Things don't change an awful lot for us. This goes back to the 2011-2013 biennium. The next one is are non-limited funds. This is the Oregon Universal Service Program. This is the pass-through funds. And as you can see, those have dropped down in recent years, and they've dropped down because the money is collected from utility bills and landlines in particular, and people are losing their landlines. So the money we're collecting under that program is actually being reduced. Our budget revenue on these two slides. On the left, as you can see, the vast majority of the funds we receive come from utility fees. There is also the surcharge for the Residential Service Protection Fund in green, a little bit of federal funds for safety programs, and business license fees, which funds the Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots. On the right-hand side, other non-limited funds, that's the $66 million per biennium that goes to the Oregon Universal Service Fund. So our budget drivers, is really personnel and other personnel expenses. About 59% of what we spend money on is personnel. And frankly, there's a tight labor market for us right now. And competition for analysts is very keen. We compete with the very people we regulate for personnel. And this has been driving up recruitment and retention costs, probably one of our biggest issues. The Oregon Telecommunications Relay Service Program, that's about 14% of our budget. The TDAP payments is about 8% of our budget. As you can imagine, we use a lot of attorney general lawyer help, and that's about 6% of our budget. Rent is about 4% of our budget, and that will be going up next year by about $10,000 per month. And then other services and supplies is about 9%.
Ms. Ackerman, if we could just go back for a second.
Sure.
The telephone relay service, that's for hearing impaired?
Mm-hmm.
With the advent of texting and so many of the other options that are available to people now, has that 14% been going up, or is it relatively stable, or has it been going down?
Chair Gomberg, members of the commission, Mike Daugherty, it's going down slightly. There's still a great demand because a lot of people don't feel very comfortable with technology, so they will go back to the OTRS. But we kind of forecast that usage will continue to go down, but it won't be significant, at least right now.
So I just want to repeat that back to you. You're talking about the challenge of technology, but relay service, essentially you plug a machine into your telephone and you type.
Yes.
And they get a readout and type back, and that's where the communication is. We're not talking about live operators that are communicating from a hearing impaired to a hearing person.
Sometimes they're involved live operators. So there's the machines, the TDAP machines on the typing allows you to do that. But a lot of times what they're doing, they're typing something into a operator, and then the operator then is either typing that to someone else or speaking that to the other person on the line. So if I'm a hearing impaired and I'm talking to someone that isn't hearing impaired, I will type something in, the operator will see it, speak to the person, and then the other person on the line will speak back to the operator and they'll type it in.
14%.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Regarding cost containment, budget management at the PUC consists of a recently reduction in supervisory personnel, reduction in administrative personnel, vacancies and other savings, transfer of telecommunications division personnel into energy. We're finding more activity on the energy side these days in telecommunications, and deferral of IT purchases. We have one major expense I've been coming up, which it relates to us moving. You get to take over our old building, and we're at temporary facilities at the at the airport right now. So we are going to not go back to our original building, and we signed a 10-year lease at the, it was in our cover page, it's at the Blue Cross Blue Shield building, which is downtown on about High and Ferry Street. But that has bumped up costs for us. So moving furniture and tenant improvements, plus the $10,000 additional month in rent, will decrease our balance of funds by about $750,000 to $1 million. Environmental factors. Our population will continue to grow, and as the population grows, that translates directly into greater demand for utility services. Although one thing that is clearly true in the last few years is that what consumers are asking for is changing. The energy markets in particular are undergoing rapid changes as telecommunications and technology advances are being integrated with the grid. Distributed generation like solar, photovoltaics, microturbines, and fuel cells are increasing the complexity of utility operations and customer expectations. And so these changes are really raising some fundamental questions about long-standing regulatory concepts that will require considerable policy adaptation by our staff and by us. The slower regional economic growth, the slower regional economic recovery created, although this is turning around right now, increased demand for utility assistance programs. Emerging federal laws and rules regarding greenhouse gas emissions and energy consumption, including one particular big one, the United States Environmental Protection Agency's rulemaking under Section 111D, the Clean Air Act, which is regulating greenhouse gas emissions from existing power plants, will fill up a lot of our time over the next few years. There have been heightened concerns about the risks posed by cyber attacks on utility infrastructure and also major earthquakes at utility facilities, and so that is something that we have wrapped into our responsibility as well. The need for utilities to invest in capital projects to meet growing demand of customers, changes in technology, and federal and state mandates will always be there. Increasingly, energy utility customers are demanding different kinds of options from the utilities, like green tariff options and other things that require a greater selection and availability of renewable power and other things that they have not had to have not asked for in the past. There is, and this isn't a joke, possible significant regional load growth due to Measure 91. The growing operations can use a lot of energy, and so that's something we're keeping our eye on. Federal laws and rules promoting the development of broadband, as well as fundamental changes to universal service funding, are underway at the federal level, and we'll be dealing with that and considering that too. There is a continued decrease in telephone landline use due to cellular phones, voice over internet protocol, and internet usage such as Skype. There's rapid growth in applicants seeking free Oregon telecommunications assistance program and lifeline services by prepaid wireless companies. And I mentioned this earlier, but one of our biggest administrative challenges at the commission is retaining and recruiting and training qualified professionals with experience in utility analysis and operations. That's a huge challenge for us, and it puts us in the position of competing with the very people we regulate sometimes for personnel. Although they do a great job, and at this point I'm going to back off and invite the Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots to come up and address a few of their issues.
Right, very good. Thank you, Ms. Ackerman.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, absolutely.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Members of the committee, my name is Kim Duncan, and I am the Vice Chair of the Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots. And with me today is Tom Marcraft, who had just previously chaired the board, and the first time in 170 years, Executive Director of the Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots. We're going to tell you why his role is so necessary for us.
I'm just curious, have you had a really long search going on, or what?
I'll say.
Age as well.
Actually, PUC referenced how long they've been serving the state. And the Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots is the oldest board in the state, formed significantly before we had statehood, but not significantly before we had commerce up the Columbia River. And that gave a generation to the need to regulate that commerce. We have been part of the PUC for the last 8 years. It was a really good place for us to be because they understand regulatory challenges, and we have had a number of them. Let me just quickly give you a little information about our budget. It's easy for you. It's only about $837,000. But the size of the budget belies both the complexity of the work we do and the economic impact of what our pilots do. Maritime pilots board all the transits that are coming into Coos Bay, Aquinnah Bay, over the bar and up the river to the various ports to Portland. And they steer these ships of all different sizes, shapes, lengths, depths, weight, safely up the river. If there's an error, if there's an oil spill, for example, the kind of money we're talking about and the damage we're talking about is exceedingly significant. You may all have read about a terrible incident in San Francisco Bay several years ago where a pilot rammed into the pilings of the Bay Bridge. And that damage was significant. So what we attempt to do here, and we do it pretty darn well, is to make sure we have safe passage. We do that by hiring the best. And we search naturally for our pilots. We do that by requiring that they maintain proficiencies through continued professional education and development. We do that by making sure we're up on safety practice, best safety practices and regulations, and that we are understanding what's happening in our industry all over the country. Every place we have major ports, we have pilots, so we have some comparables to look at in terms of practices. Now, I just want to go through a couple of pieces of information that are in the annual report you have. The annual report's a really easy way to get a sense of what we do. Last year we had 4,400 total transits. That means ships coming up and down rivers, in and out of ports, and being moved from one anchorage to another anchorage. That happens particularly in Portland a lot. Each one of those moves or journeys requires a pilot on board, on the bridge, directing what happens. And that's because the pilot knows the ports and the rivers intimately. Captains that are coming in from all over the world don't have that same degree of knowledge. Out of those 4,400 transits, there were only four incidents, what we call maritime incidents. Three of them involved boarding the ships. This is where things get pretty dangerous for the men and women who do this work. You'll have to climb. If you've ever had the challenge of climbing or coming down a ship ladder, you find your heart, up in your throat. These folks have to do that when they're boarding a ship that's already at sea, or they come in on a helicopter and are dropped to the deck or picked up on the deck. We had a pilot who's dropped from the helicopter, gave him a broken shoulder earlier this year. Sometimes, particularly foreign flag vessels, don't keep their ship ladders in the kind of shape you want, and somebody grabs a ladder and they're out there in the sea and something happens and their life is actually at stake. And when you fall into the water, it's hard to know what's going to happen. We are looking in this next budget round to increase our executive director's position from a 0.5 to a full-time. We are funding our budget and this position from the license fees that we charge our licensed pilots and from a surcharge on the transits that come in, so there's no general fund involved. When Mr. Burnett joined us last April, he had a huge pent-up demand for his professional services, his analytical capacity, his ability to assess what's coming down the pike that's facing this board. Previously, the three public members on the board had to provide that kind of service to the board, and it was a bit overwhelming, I have to say. We're smart, but this was really a lot of work for us. So when Eric joined us, we were able then to launch a number of pretty exciting and significantly required programs. If I would like you to just take a couple minutes to hear from Eric about what's on the agenda as we move forward.
Co-Chair Gomberg and representatives, thank you very much for the opportunity. I really appreciate it. I've got three major initiatives on my plate at this point.
And if I could just have you just formally introduce yourself for the record, we'd appreciate that.
Oh, absolutely. My apologies. Eric Burnett, Executive Director, Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots.
Welcome.
I've got three initiatives on my plate at this point. The first is dealing with medical oversight, and in essence, what we're looking for is better, clearer visibility into the medical issues that individual pilots and collective pilots have collectively within our group. It was a major issue in San Francisco in the Costco Busan incident, and there were a lot of lessons learned throughout the pilot community and the regulatory community. We're in the process of redrafting our OARs, our administrative rules, to allow for a medical oversight officer. That would be, in essence, our eyes, our medical eyes, into the collective health and fitness for duty of the pilot pool as a whole. The next initiative I've got on my plate, which also relates to or has ties to the Costco Busan incident as well, is a revamp of how we do investigations. Investigating an incident, we have very few of them, fortunately, but investigating an incident requires a very specific set of knowledge that is very scarce, frankly. We're in the process of looking at these investigations as an insurable risk. In that we are working with the Department of Administrative Services to ensure against high cost investigations, and thereby allow us to bring a better pool of talent to the table than we otherwise could get through a conventional RFP process. And finally, the third task on my plate is very simply data and metrics. We have the ability to pull in a lot of data. What we need to do is figure out what is germane, pull it together, and turn it into metrics that are usable internally for us as a board, and also externally to push back out to the state agencies and regional agencies. To answer things like economic development questions. Those are the primary things that are on my plate right now. So I'll turn that back over to Kim Duncan.
We're happy to answer any questions. I think you have most of the information that you'll need in the annual report. We certainly hope you will support our 1 FTE move on this budget. Thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you all. I was looking at the fact sheet that was provided with the
yes.
annual report,
mm-hmm.
and I think I'd direct this question to Mr. Burnett. I'm just
yes.
First of all, the second item there, the 1,576 total inbounds, is that for all three ports?
That is for the Columbia River ports.
That's just Columbia River.
Columbia River ports, which would include the Columbia River Bar and the Columbia River per se.
Right. I wanted to use that as a jumping-off point to ask about the changes at Terminal 6, and I see 51 inbound transits for Hanjin. I would anticipate that means about 102 round trips that probably are not going to be taking place in the next cycle.
Yes, sir. Exactly. That represents roughly 3.1% of the total volume of pilotage load in the system. Just a Hanjin alone.
3%.
Yes.
All right. Thank you. Other questions?
Mr. Chairman, but that's not to be confused with the value of the loads that Hanjin was bringing in.
Yes.
Or not.
Yes. Yeah. But.
Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Well, thank you so very much.
Thank you. Thank you for that.
Have a couple of bills this year. One is Senate Bill 286 regarding civil penalties. As I indicated earlier, we get money from the federal government. The Pipeline Hazardous Materials and Safety Administration gives us money to fund our gas safety staff, and they implement the federal regulations, and they want us to adopt all the regulations that they adopt and apply, which includes their civil penalties. And so For the longest time, our penalties have been up to $10,000 per event per day, with a maximum of $500,000 or for a related series of violations. To maintain full funding, the federal agency wants us to increase our penalties to $200,000 per event per day and a maximum of $2 million for a related series of violations. So that is one bill we have in front of you. I'll be honest with you, we don't assess penalties frequently, number one, because our operators are pretty good at what they do, and we'd rather see, philosophically, we would rather see them actually just getting safety right rather than assessing penalties. But that is a condition of getting continued funding at the levels where we become accustomed to. The next one is Senate Bill 329. As I indicated earlier, we are funded by a per-month charge on bills, which represents a small sliver of utility gross operating fee that the utilities pay. Currently, it's at about 0.25%, and we'd like to increase that to 0.3%. This is the fee that funds the utility program, about 90% of policy and administration. What's happening is that because people are giving up landlines and we've got a fairly effective energy conservation ethic in the state of Oregon, the revenues that are subject to this percentage fee are going down, and therefore our revenues are going down. So what this would mean is an increase in the average utility bill assessment from about 17 cents per month to 20 cents per month. Without the increase, we project a 2015-17 deficit of $4.6 million and the next biennium deficit of $5.2 million. The maximum assessment that we're asking for will result in an additional $5.2 million for 2015-17 and then an additional $5.7 million for 2017-2019. Although our revenues have decreased, our programs and operating expenses have increased from 28.7 million in 2013 to 15 to 30.9 million. That's at current service level. So our major expenses are personnel, other personnel expenses like PERS, benefits, employment taxes, AG fees, and rent. Moving on, this is a chart that just very quickly, if you want to look at it, that shows you what the gross revenue fee is, how our budget works out, and then what our actual expenses are. There are just three simple points to make about this. The first is that our expenditures are consistently under budget, but still we've had a $2.8 million deficit for the period. Expenses $2.8 million greater than revenue. And what we have been doing is...
Yes, Senator Monroe.
When's the last time your fees were increased?
Decades ago, as a percentage.
That's 17 cents.
Yeah, that's 17 cents. I think it's been in place for decades.
Co-chair, Senator Monroe, it's been 2.5 mils since 1997, and it's been less than that, but as far as the statute goes back many, many decades. We did drop it 1 year to 1.5 mil. Because what we saw, our balance was getting high and we wanted to bring it down, so we brought it down for the 1 year, dropped it, and then we've been able to maintain a balance for quite a while until recently, where it's getting a little bit more difficult, mainly because of telephone landlines.
Follow up,
please.
Is there a statutory cap?
This is a maximum, so co-chair and Tim. So 0.25%, that's a maximum, that's a statutory
cap.
And we're trying to change the statutory cap to 0.3%.
Okay. And the 0.25 has not been exceeded for a long time, ever?
I go back as far as 1997. And things were counted a little bit differently then, but it's been pretty steady at 0.25.
The reason I ask you is any time you're increasing a fee, that question is going to be asked by somebody on the Ways and Means Committee, so I might as well do it here.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. The next few pages are other utility legislative concepts that are coming our way this year. These are not bills that we have introduced, but they relate to the PUC. And as you can see, it's going to be quite an active legislative session for us. I won't spend any time on these bills unless you have particular questions about them. Instead, I would go to slide 49, which describes our 10% reduction options and long-term vacancies. Our 10% reduction option would come from services and supplies at just under $1 million, OTAP reimbursements of $2.5 million, personnel of $1 million, for a total 10% reduction of $4.5 million. We have two long-term vacancies right now, an OS2 and an OPA2. These recruitments have been on hold and may be used for funding two additional utility analyst positions based on our need to respond to the Environmental Protection Agency's Section 111D greenhouse gas regulations and other legislative requirements and increased natural gas pipeline requirements. So that's where we are.
Very good. Any other questions for Ms. Ackerman? And I would guess, Mr. Miller, have you got something for us?
Yes. Could you go and pull that up? Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Travis Miller with the Chief Financial Office. Go to the next slide. I think you've heard a lot of the policy and funding issues, the first being the moving costs. It's primarily other funds, but there's some federal funds implicated. That's an additional $175,000. That was addressed during the construction of the governor's budget. Additional limitation was provided during the appeal. However, limitation does not equate with revenue. So just because we gave them permission to spend the money doesn't mean they actually have it. So clarification. You're welcome. In terms of the Oregon Universal Service Fund, that continues to decline for the reasons stated before, essentially fewer landlines. In terms of the Oregon's 10-year plan, the nexus between that and this agency, we're essentially looking at public safety, consumer protection. Next slide. In terms of looking at the budget over time, you see a substantial decrease, and we're looking at about a 9.1% decrease overall, and the vast majority of that reduction would be associated with the Oregon Universal Service Fund, about $13 million. So, and again, that's non-limited funds, essentially pass-through dollars, so those are not operational. In terms of the FTE, it's essentially been static and is going down. So outside of the Oregon Universal Service Fund, it's relatively stable. The only policy option package is for the Board of Maritime Pilots, so they're not asking for anything. And also, just to clarify, Senate Bill 329 was not included in the governor's budget. That was sponsored by a member. And lastly, we have the policy option package, which I think was thoroughly discussed, increasing it from 0.5 to 1 FTE. And in looking at the comparators amongst other ports, it's eminently reasonable. We're pretty far behind. And that's about it, unless you have questions.
Questions? No questions. Well done. Thank you, Mr. Miller, Ms. Ackerman, and please thank the you were going to say something.
No, I was just going to thank you, Chair Gomberg, for and the committee for hearing us out. Thank you.
Excellent. Please,
can I just ask one question? Early on, Ms. Ackerman, early on in your slide deck, you talked about balancing the interests of the ratepayers with the utilities, and I get it that sometimes those are at odds with each other. But when you say the utilities, what does that mean? Does that mean the shareholders of the utilities?
Yes, exactly.
And so, may I follow?
Please.
So do you take into account the share price, or explain to me how that process works there?
It's actually pretty complicated, but what you're doing is you're looking at goes to U.S. constitutional law, basically. It's the concept that when private persons devote private property for the public use, which is what's essentially going on with shareholders funding plant for utilities that goes on to serve the public, that they have the right to recover that and to earn a fair amount on that investment. And so a lot of what we're doing when we're looking at what the utility is charging customers is figuring out what costs are they incurring for that service, are they reasonable? Then the utility gets an opportunity to recover those costs and recover what's considered a fair return on the invested capital. And that's a pretty complicated process, but that's what we spend a lot of our time in rate cases talking about with the utilities.
Thank you. Can I follow one little? I don't want to eat up all the committee's time with this. Is there some discussion of that? If I wanted to learn more about that process, how could I find out more about that? Do you have any resources for me?
I do. I could send you an email with some links that would be probably more than you'd want, but I'll see if I can't find something.
Don't mess with me, Mrs. Ackerman.
Co-Chair Gumberg, Representative Nierman, at any time I can send staff, myself or someone else, to come talk about these issues. They're pretty complicated issues. The actual equation is really simple, but what goes into making that happen is very complex. But you know, we'll be at your time. Whenever you want us to come over, we can come over and discuss it.
Good, thank you. I might take you up on that.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Well, again, thank you, and thank the Maritime Board as well.
Thank you.
We have two people signed up. I would invite. You want to both come up together? Mr. Bissonnette and Mr. Bauer, welcome. Mr. Bissonnette, I have you signed up first, so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonnette. I represent the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. We represent the residential ratepayers of the regulated utilities. We spend a lot of time in front of the commission, working with the commission staff, and I'm here to strongly and heartily support their budget. They have a very good staff. They run very good processes. Really, without going into too much hyperbole, they really represent the one of the best examples of open and good government. We do deal with a lot of tough issues, a lot of hard issues, but Oregon really is known for a collaborative process where people are heard, and we don't win all the time, the utilities don't win all the time, but the commission is very good at explaining their decisions, so even if you don't agree with them, you know why the decision was made. I'll say, too, that you heard about Senate Bill 329, their fee bill. We did also testify in support of that in the Senate committee, and it is tough retaining quality staff. It is a very competitive market. The utilities, frankly, can pay more than the PUC, but at the same time, many utilities recognize that you need professional, knowledgeable, long-term staff to just help keep the process moving along. But anyway, I'll stop there and again do encourage you to support the PUC's budget. I'm happy to answer questions. Thank you.
Any questions? Well, thank you so much for joining us. Mr. Bauer.
Thank you, Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. I'm Gary Bauer with Northwest Natural. And I'll say ditto to what Mr. Bissonnette just said regarding the commission and its staff and how it operates. I would like to kind of pick up briefly on the question that Representative Nierman kind of asked, and I will say that Ms. Ackerman actually made it sound quite simple, I thought. It is not a simple process. It can take easily up to 10 months to go through a rate proceeding, and that proceeding has very detailed technical expertise involved, both from the utilities, from the Citizens Utility Board, and from the commission staff. As was mentioned, they have economists, financial analysts, they have people with very specific technical expertise. For utility, that's very important to us, that they have that level of expertise. As Ms. Ackerman mentioned, they do have some issues related to recruitment and retention. I know you don't have the authority to do this, but our company would strongly recommend that to the extent you could work with DAS or whoever else analyzes and sets the salaries for professional staff, that they truly look at the marketplace and look at some of the competition. And we're competing. They're competing with us to hire these people. At the end of the day, we want well-qualified expertise at the commission. It benefits our customers, and it also benefits the companies. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Excellent. Thank you both, gentlemen. Anybody else signed up? I think everybody in the room has already spoken. Well, that being the case, I will go ahead and conclude this hearing on Senate Bill 5535. And is there anything else we need to cover here today? All right. Mr. Burkle, you make certain that Representative Witsup, Senator Johnson, watch the full tape of the hearing before we get together next week.
Representative, I'm not sure I'm the boss of them, but I will do my best.
All right. Thank you all, and I'll go ahead and adjourn at this point. Thank you. Thank you.